Hello, and welcome to the latest episode in the Enterprise Times podcast series. My name is Ian Murphy, and my guest today is Evan Kaplan, CEO of Influx Data. We're going to be talking about time series data. It's an area that many organizations are only just beginning to address as they realize the vast amount of timestamp data they are capturing. Evan, hello.
How are you doing, Ian? Thanks for having me. I have a long background in technology and entrepreneurship. My early days in technology were in aerospace. In the early days of networking, TCP/IP networking, I started a company that did the first SSL VPNs that ended up part of Dell Technologies. And I ran a global Wi-Fi company. I joined Influx Data about 4 years ago, pretty excited about the market, about the open source platform, and all the dynamics around what I could see happening with time series.
Time series, what does it actually mean?
It's almost eponymous, right? The idea is that you're collecting data that is time-stamped. Very simply, it is instrumented by time. Imagine sensors out there in the world, whether your system's monitoring, instrumenting anything, where you're looking at what changes over time, temperature, volume, pressure, humidity, storage. You're indexing all that information based on time. It turns out a huge amount of the data in the world is indexed just exactly like that.
Companies don't necessarily realize how much is time-stamped. How do businesses begin to understand what is time-stamped data?
It's one of those things that over the last period of time, particularly the last 5 years, it's a foreground background issue like most things in technology. When you think about how data is collected, most data is collected with a timestamp. If you were doing this 20 years ago, you would have taken an Oracle database and you have written some application logic to basically table it based on time, if that was your primary vector of interest. If you were to do this 10 years ago, you might have done it on MySQL. 5 years ago, you might have done it on Cassandra or HBase. What's happened in the market is that increasingly you see these specialized platforms. You see the breakup of relational database for everything into these specialized categories, whether it be search databases, document databases, graph databases. Now, the largest and fastest growing among those is time series database. Our view is that most data is actually best understood in the context of time. What happened, what happened, what happened, what's going to happen?
If I think about a cybersecurity environment, one of the challenges people often have when they're dealing with an attack is there may be traces of that attack across multiple sensors. They've got log files here, a log file on that system, something in the seam. What they often struggle with is assembling that in that correct chronological order so they can see all the various elements. How quickly are you seeing different parts of organizations look at time series and say, it gives us a better picture?
I would argue that, having been in the security market myself for a long time, is that the security market, looking at data streams coming across in time, correlating across attacks, is probably, outside of IoT, the most aggressive user of time series data. Most applications, most services, whether they be firewall, whether they be intrusion detection, whether they be anomaly detection, are tied to time series data. They're the most sophisticated users. A lot of our customers are those companies who use Influx either open source or build their own products around time series. It's core in that cybersecurity market. Event, 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 event.
If I look at many organizations rolling their own cybersecurity solution, many are still trying to do this on a SQL database, or they're moving to NoSQL because they don't understand time series like some of the vendors do. How easy is it for them to bring that data across from where they're currently capturing it and import that into a time series database?
You know, it's relatively easy. Us and other vendors in the market have built tools to be able to translate. We've built tools that you can query it with SQL-like languages and capabilities. And so it's not technically a problem. Whether it's worth for historical data or whether you start a new stream of collection going forward, that's often an organization's decision, but it's not a difficult problem.
What about volume? If we look at the amount of data that's coming in, that's far larger than many are generally geared up for in their various databases. Let's look at a different example, IoT in vehicles. We know that the average vehicle is going to generate tens of gigabytes of data per day. Much of that is going to be tiny little records from lots and lots of different systems. We're going to need to assemble that to understand the health of a vehicle. Is that going to be easy to import and to assemble? Or do we need to start rethinking the way that we capture the data to begin with?
When you think about the IoT edge, let's think about it this way. There are four or five things that a time series database has to do super well that a normal database doesn't have to do well. The first is it needs to be able to write at super high speed and at high resolution. A platform like ours, we have nanosecond resolution. It's used by NIST. It's used in quantum computing. You have to be able to write at super high speeds, at super high resolution. Two is you need to be able to downsample that, because if you're capturing nanosecond data, then you don't want to store that forever. Downsampling is a core part of time series stuff, because what happens is you want to keep high resolution data for a relatively short period of time. This is true in cybersecurity too. You want to keep lower resolution data over a long period of time, and even lower resolution over potentially permanently, so that you mitigate some of the storage. The third thing is you have to be able to compress the data. Time series databases, not all of them, but most of them are very good at compressing the data so that storage on disk becomes a less and less of a problem. As you think about compressing the data, because you know the fundamental format is tied to time, it's relatively easy to compress it significantly. And the fourth thing, which is probably the least understood, is you have to be able to evict data, which is contrary to what most databases do. You have to be able to evict data at speed. Imagine you've got super high resolution cybersecurity data about events across a global network that are coming in hundreds to millions a second. You want to boil out the pattern and downsample. Evicting data is a super expensive process in a normal relational database. It's designed to be a much, much less expensive process in a time series database. Those four things are really fundamental.
In that import, you talked about compressing data and choosing your data. Is there a point where we need to think about pre-processing that volume of data? A modern jet engine has hundreds of individual sensors providing a constant stream of data when we have a failure or when we're trying to do preventative maintenance. We need to keep all data. But if we were capturing from a radio telescope, there's a lot of that data that isn't important that we can throw away. How do we make that decision to pre-process or not pre-process, keep or not keep, before we get it into the database?
That's a really good question. Now we're starting to talk really meaningfully about what I would say is the leading edge of IoT. As part of our product or our open source, there's a collection agent called Telegraph. Telegraph can decide which information gets routed and figure out which of it gets sent up to our cloud or gets sent up to an open source database. The cutting edge of this is actually processing at the edge, in which the thing at the edge decides which information gets shipped up for long-term storage and which is essentially only available for a short period of time. There's this really important relationship between time series at the edge and time series in the cloud or in a central facility, in which all information doesn't necessarily need to be. We'll do more and more processing at the edge than we currently do today. Today, the edge is largely dumb, but that will change over time.
That's interesting that you say it's largely dumb, because we've seen accelerators starting to go into the edge of the network inside switches, inside routers. One of the things we've learned in the last few months is there is no edge anymore to our network. Wherever we have an employee, it's the edge of our network. How do we begin to decide where we deploy collection agents effectively?
When you say there is no edge of the network, you're coming from your cybersecurity background, in which there was perceived to be an internal and an external, which was always an illusion. If you think about cybersecurity risk, your larger risk is from internal than it is from external most times. When we think about IoT, we think about the edge differently. We're not thinking about the cybersecurity frame in which there's an internal and an external. You're thinking about everything being external, which is the right frame. What people are talking about in the IoT world when they talk about an intelligent edge is the notion that over time, you can basically use machine learning to understand what needs to be collected, what's relevant, what's not, to make more efficient that edge processing, which in the end makes your decision making, whether it's security or whether it's a control system or whatever, makes it more facile. You don't have network latency you have to build into everything, that things can happen independently but be capable of syncing.
Does that mean we can start to look at deploying, as that edge element, smaller time series databases which are doing their analysis on that particular jet engine or on that connected vehicle, doing a set of analysis, then backloading to a core time series database where it's easier to shift that data because it's already in the right format we need for faster loading?
Precisely. I want to be sensitive to this is about time series in general and not about us, but when we look at this business of time series, we don't see it as just a database business. There's lots of capabilities. You need to have a cloud native platform. You need to have, we believe, an open source platform so people can deploy it liberally at the edge, build what they want. We have customers who deploy time series at the edge, process it at the edge, and then forward that data to the cloud where relevant. That will be a common architecture going forward. It's not good enough to just offer a service that's in the cloud. You have to have people be able to build it into devices. People have built it, in our case, into devices as small as Raspberry Pis. That ability to take the open source and to put it at the edge is really important for us. And we think important for anybody who participates in this market.
One of the challenges with vast volumes of data come in is scale. We have always struggled with massive scale, particularly when that scale has to happen quickly. One of the reasons for Oracle looking at an autonomous database was that systems can make a better decision on scaling and moving and location of data than people. Is it possible to simply manually manage large time series databases? Or do we need to move to a world where we see much more autonomous function given the volume of data and the need to scale?
If you and I have the broader intellectual conversation, there is nothing in the compute information architecture that doesn't need to move to more autonomous over time. Nothing. No part of it. The network, the compute, the storage, it generally needs to become more intelligent. And where time series fits in that is, how do you build intelligent systems? It's a really simple model, an old cybernetic model. You instrument, you look for anomalies, you capture those anomalies in your future code, and then you instrument again. Do that a couple of million times, and you get a self-driving car. You instrument, you observe, you change, you instrument, you observe, you change, and pretty soon the system is self-correcting and self-healing. Not pretty soon, actually, it takes a long time. Databases are one part of that, but the whole IoT world is built on that notion. It all starts with instrumentation, and instrumentation is all about collecting time-specific data. That's why we feel so strongly about the relationship between smart systems and time series data. Is it starts with observing all of the permutations of the behavior and capturing it.
Once we've got all this data, how do we query it? It's very easy to say, we've got this data. The system is capable of managing itself and growing at scale. But you and I have been around databases long enough to know that it doesn't take much to cripple a database with a badly written query. The more data you've got for it to trawl through, the easier it is to cripple everything. So how do we create a better, queryable, vast database?
It's a great question and insightful from your part. These are fundamental compute problems. It goes almost beyond the notion of a query. To me, the better notion is not the query, which is part of it, but the control system. If you're building a sophisticated control system, of which a self-driving car is a pretty incredible example, you're not thinking about it in terms of query. You're thinking in terms of control. Query almost sounds too slow. Have to query the database to get the information. That is functionally what's going on, but it's something that sounds much faster and is much faster and needs to be much faster for it to be relevant. I tend to think about it, maybe it's my background, as a control system. Control systems have to act, and acting on the data is super important. What's happening in the database world is this standalone database model, autonomous or not, to me seems really only of limited interest. What's really interesting to me are the cloud native platforms, the serverless, the infinitely scalable, the elastic kinds of models that go on, in which the scale is not the problem. The performance is not the problem, but performance is the opportunity. The idea is that if your database is in the cloud, it's built on this microservice framework, it's serverless, and it's infinitely scalable, and developers can write to it really easy, that's the grail. That really is the grail. We're not the only ones doing that. You know, Amazon's done that with some of the core databases, as has Microsoft, as has Google with Bigtable and Query. This, I fundamentally believe, is the future of data platforms, these cloud-native, elastic, serverless platforms. We've spent the last 2 years building that from our standard off-the-shelf database.
But once we've got this huge amount of data, how do we then secure it?
That's your job.
But it's always been that problem, hasn't it? We pull all this data into a database. We say to people, it's got everything we need to know. Now, just ask it the right question. The problem is, because it's got all that data, it's a dangerous weapon. It's like handing people a loaded gun and not telling them which end the bullet comes out of. How do we look at these ever-increasing stores of data that are going to have a large amount of privacy data and ensure that we are capable of managing access, capable of controlling the flow of data, capable of controlling who can query the database appropriately?
I would love to opine on that subject. It would be easy to do. I am no longer an expert. The database itself can have very sophisticated access control, very fine-grained access control, and you do your best to do that. By the way, that's at the edge too, not just in the core. You're vulnerable for sensors that have databases. So the database can play its role. For an entire system, an IoT system, it's much more than just the database. It's the network, it's in the transport. And this is where you will stay professionally employed for the remainder of your life as you and the variety of vendors, because you know the problem with security. As long as there are humans building things, there are going to be security vulnerabilities. It is a fundamental problem that needs to stay hand in glove with the development of technology. Let me just leave it at that.
Let's scale this. We've talked about a jet engine, a connected car as IoT systems. We're moving towards smart cities, which are going to be collections of highly complex, highly integrated databases, some of which will need to be time series, some of which will need to be other technologies. How do we create an architecture that is capable of bringing together multiple types of database technology in a coherency to run something like a smart city?
This is a great question. I think you already see it happening. If you look at how the major cloud vendors, there would be Azure, whether Google, Amazon, they basically have multiple database services that have interaction with each other. Increasingly, a database service is part of a broader whole. Some of that data will want to be exported into relational. Some of that will want to be streamed. Some of that will want to be batched. Increasingly, architects of large applications and large services, and I would say almost all of our larger customers fit into this, have gotten pretty facile with design around this sort of stuff, where this data is stored, where that data is stored, how it's pulled together, where it's integrated. I think this is the future of database architecture, as opposed to I'm an Oracle expert and I build everything on Oracle. That world has changed.
But how far can that world change? If we look around, job postings are still product focused. They are still role focused. We're still looking for a DBA who can work on a particular vendor's solution. We're not seeing a more generic data builder, for want of a better phrase, somebody who has the skills to weave an architecture from multiple different types of data sources. If we're going to make that jump, that can't be a rarefied role like a data scientist role. It has to be a much wider, more accessible job structure.
I agree. You and I both know that there are people still working on terminal emulators. There are people still doing COBOL code. And so an Oracle DB as a job description won't disappear. But if you look at, let's call them tier one forward edge companies, whether they're building yet these services, whether it be social media or any kind of service at scale, they're already good at this. people are already on that journey of a full stack developers, full stack architects. There's a lot of people getting trained in Silicon Valley, in London, in Cambridge, who are actually quite good at this. Apprenticeship model experience running these large services at scale. It's just the normal evolution of things.
We're moving the use of machine learning, the use of artificial intelligence. How does time series play into artificial intelligence? Does it simplify the creation of that initial machine learning into the decision making of the AI solution? Or is it more of a supplemental data support system?
That's a really good question. At the risk of saying that time series does everything for everybody, whitens teeth and turns my hair from gray to original brown color, I will say, let's think about what we're talking about, whether you call it AI, whether you call it machine learning, whether you call it predictive analytics, predictive maintenance. That's time series' sweet spot. Essentially, you're trying to say, back to what I said earlier, which is, what happened, what happened, what happened, what happened, what happened, what's going to happen? That is the function of time series. How do I predict from a set of data that goes back over different period of times with different conditions? How do I predict forward? So fundamentally, time series and machine learning are coupled at the hip. It's not to say that things like graph databases and other databases don't play a role. I just think time series is so instrumental. Back to my notion is you can't do machine learning without instrumentation.
So where does somebody start? Where do they make that decision that time series is the solution for them? How do they then move towards selecting and building a time series database solution?
Maybe we're biased because we're the open source vendor. We really believe fundamentally in the nature and the power of open source. Most people start with a simple, either run it in our cloud or they download the open source and they deploy it. They'll start with looking at what their requirements, how many writes, what their query speed needs to be. They just start building on it. The same thing happens at large corporations where they realize that their existing relational database platform is failing over, even with time series built into it. Most of our world is people experiment with the open sources. It's starting to change. A lot of people are going to the cloud first. But historically, the open source allows developers to really get intimate with the whole notion of time series and the power of it. Most people are liberated by it. If they've had to solve the problems another way, they feel liberated.
You've just announced your latest version today. Can you give us the headline bits as to why I should go and buy it?
I don't know if you should. That's just to be completely honest. Actually, you should download the open source and start playing with it. That's what we urge a lot of people to do, or try it free in the cloud and that sort of stuff. Today, we announced our availability on Azure. We're now available on AWS, on Google, and on Azure. The idea is coming back to this multi-database world is that people are going to assemble those solutions increasingly in these cloud-native environments. They're going to ask that they be serverless. They're going to ask that they be elastic. They're going to want to use that as a fundamental tenet of their platform and their architecture. So the announcement today is just that we're now available on Azure. That's important because Microsoft has such a long history of relationship with large enterprises, more so than Google and Amazon. So we're excited to be on that platform. And the idea is that increasingly these architectures aren't just within one cloud, they're multi-cloud and they're hybrid cloud. And just as I mentioned, they're potentially open source at the edge, they're cloud in the core, and maybe enterprise versions in the middle. These kind of announcement, that broad availability is really important to us. The second part of announcement is our partnership with PTC. PTC is the owner of ThingWorks, the largest IoT platform out there. They've been a partner of ours for some time. We've worked together, and they are building our cloud native product directly into their offering in the cloud. If you think about IoT, you think about time series. Sensors speak time series. It's just very clear whether it's pressure, temperature, volume, humidity, whatever it happens to be measuring, they're measuring it in time. PTC is a leader in this industrial IoT space, and they'll be offering Influx as part of their core product.
Do you see customers beginning to look for multi-cloud environments? As press and as an analyst, we talk a lot about the potential for multi-cloud, but there's often a significant gap between vendors, press, analysts, and the people who then consume it.
It's certainly easier to be single cloud. I do everything in Amazon, in Azure, or GCP. That's an easier story. The truth is, as these clouds grow over time and their offers are different, some are better, some are worse, some are things that you're multi-cloud anyway, because you get a certain service relevant to your industry that's potentially built in Azure, but you have these other databases and AWS. The trend, it's very hard to stay single cloud if you're building something sophisticated. Increasingly, the cloud service providers recognize this and they are open to it.
That raises a question about yourselves being on multiple clouds. Is one of the reasons for being on multiple clouds the sheer fact that it doesn't then matter what the customer chooses to use and where? The bottom line is you can deploy so all the tools they use, all the data formats are identical no matter where it is.
Single API. Our message is single API across cloud, across on-prem, across versions. API works wherever. Build it once, run it where you need to. We think that's critical for this future architecture, particularly as you start looking at these API-driven companies.
I think the first time I heard the phrase build once, run anywhere must be 20, 25 years ago.
Java, build once, run anywhere.
It's been a fabulous conversation.
You asked me really good, pithy questions. I've really enjoyed it.